Good evening. You're listening to 97.3 WRIR LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Today on Open Source RVA, Jeff Roll of the James River Film Society and horror film expert Doc Gillespie talk about this weekend's Halloween Horror Showcase at the Visual Arts Center. And the Richmond investigators of the paranormal, our city's big game ghost hunters, explain why it's always open season on Richmond's Spirit World. And we'll hearken back to a time when the paranormal passed for science with Sean Kane of the American Civil War Center at Historic Tredegar, who presents for your terror this week, American Seance. Brace yourself. It's a very special Halloween edition of Open Source RVA. But first, the news.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. Amidst nationwide voter registration scandals, Virginia is having its share of the action. The Virginia State Board of Elections voted unanimously this Wednesday to ask State Attorney General Kent Cuccinelli to look into fraud claims against Virginia Republican Party hired consultant Colin Small, who allegedly threw voter registration forms in the trash. Small was originally hired by Strategic Allied Consulting, a company formed this summer by Nathan Sproul, a paid Romney campaign consultant. Sproul has led other companies that over the years have been repeatedly accused of tampering with voter registration forms, though no formal charges have ever been brought against him. Strategic Allied Consulting came under fire in September for similar allegations, and the GOP publicly disavowed the firm. The former employee Small still found work within the party. Senator Donald McEachin, who called for Cuccinelli to further probe the allegations, received a letter from the Attorney General Monday that agreed an investigation was totally warranted and noted that local authorities were on the case. He further noted that as Attorney General, he couldn't start an investigation without word from the State Board of Elections, that he would happily support a legislative effort by McEachin in the next General Assembly session to provide this authority to his office. The Board of Elections has now spoken, and Cuccinelli must appoint a committee immediately. More than a month ago, as the school year began, Open Source RVA asked school board spokesperson Felicia Cosby to share its evacuation plans for trailers at school sites and asked how many trailers are used to house students with disabilities. Cosby told Open Source last month that the school board did not have information about how many special education students are educated in the trailers. But in January of this year, responding to a Freedom of Information Act request by former school board member Carol A. O. Wolf, the district provided an account of all of its trailers, as well as what kind of classes each of those trailers was used for. A disproportionately high number, at least 9 of those trailers, housed special needs students. Most of Richmond's 35 classroom trailers house elementary students. This week, with Hurricane Sandy bearing down on the East Coast, Cosby's office provided Open Source with the district's trailer evacuation plan. The district's tornado evacuation provisions provide minimal details for evacuating students from trailers, saying that during tornado warnings, schools are to implement evacuation from outside portable buildings to a sheltered position inside the school. No provisions are made specific to evacuating students with disabilities housed in trailers. Hurricanes can spawn tornadoes days after the initial event, as was the case with 2003's Hurricane Isabel. This Halloween, All the Saints Theater Company will throw their 7th annual Halloween parade. This year's theme is the end of the world. All sinners and saints will be welcome to dress up and trick-or-treat down Laurel Street, carrying larger-than-life puppets Critical Mass style for this Richmond holiday tradition. No BS Brass Band and others will play. The parade starts at 7 p.m. in Monroe Park, Wednesday, October 31st, which is Halloween, of course.
Sounds like a lot of supernatural baloney to me.
Supernatural, perhaps. Baloney, perhaps not.
The year is 1861. The Battle of Bull Run, Manassas to us Southerners, was supposed to offer a break from the tension of the past few years, a martial display punctuated by peace. Instead, there's carnage, and the country is plunged into 4 years of bloody war. The result? Hundreds of thousands of dead husbands and brothers, and thousands of mourning widows and loved ones. This brutal time also happened to coincide with a peculiar period, Science was still in its infancy. New technology like the telegraph, communicating across wires and thousands of miles, made it not so difficult a leap that perhaps, just perhaps, science might also bridge the divide between the here and the hereafter. I'm here with Sean Kane. He's a museum educator at the American Civil War Center, historic Tredegar to most of us, and we're talking a little about American Seance, which is a program that you guys are going to be running.
That's right, October 29th through November 2nd.
And this program just sounds cool.
Thank you, Chris.
And not just because of the seance, but because of, I guess, the history around what the seance is, right, in American culture.
Well, the seance comes out of the American spiritualism movement, which usually gets dated to 1848, when two sisters, Margaret and Kate, both young girls, claimed to be able to communicate with the ghost of a murdered peddler in their house with a system of knocks.
And by the way, spoiler alert for the listener, we're about to sneak in some history here on you while we're talking about spooky stuff. So you're about to learn something. Watch out. So these two girls sort of begin this movement.
Right. They become a sensation. They are very popular. People come to see them from they're from New York, but they become very famous. People were very credible that this could take place. Previously in the 1840s, the telegraph had become well known, and people were amazed that you'd be able to communicate through a system of taps over long distances.
Yeah, and real quick, this is a period of time where science is still sort of catching up with alchemy and with spiritualism.
Mm-hmm. People saw science in almost magical terms. They were so amazed.
Just hard to see now. Right. Everything seems so logical, right? But was a period of time where it was hard to tell fact from fiction.
To them, it did seem logical that if you were able to communicate over so long of distances, it's not that much more difficult, they thought, let's go ahead and communicate with the spirit world or the afterlife. And those taps that you would some people are familiar with seances were like a spiritual telegraph or a spiritual Morse code that they would use to communicate with departed spirits, or so they believe.
And now the reason that the Tredegar folks have decided to do this program is because there really is a very interesting and significant history of seances around the
American Civil War. Certainly. Well, as you can imagine, with the thousands of dead soldiers, people are going to be looking for some solace that they still exist, that they're in the afterlife, that they can still communicate with the living.
And again, this was a war that sort of, it was predicted to be very quick. It wasn't supposed to be anything except for sort of we get to dress in a cool uniform for a couple of weeks. And
one big battle and glory and home. But after 4 years and over 600,000 dead, it was American tragedy. So they, even if you weren't just this time period because of medical knowledge, many children would die before reaching adulthood. Willie Lincoln dies in the White House. Mary Todd Lincoln turns to spiritualism, would have mediums come to the White House, would attend seances herself.
And this must have been for the general public, which already is, it sounds like, kind of predisposed to this a little bit. Just again, from our 1840s, our teenage girls, now you've got the First Lady.
Exactly.
In Washington, believing in it.
It was a middle-class and upper-class movement. All stratas of society subscribed to it. There was a Princess Somsom, who was an American who married a Prussian prince who fought for the Union during the war.
Was her given name Somsom? Or?
No, that was his name. he was Felix Somsom, and okay. she became Princess Somsom. She was a very interesting character. I believe she had been a circus performer at one point of her life,
but she's usually the
route
to
go
to princess,
becoming a princess, right. Exactly. She wrote about in her memoirs that the spiritualism and mediums were everywhere, and that's all you heard about in the parlors of America during the Civil War. I like this. If some of you may be familiar at a seance, sometimes a table will rise She said all tables and other furnitures seem to have come alive in the parlors throughout America.
So let's talk a little bit about that. We were talking before the program a bit about, again, going back to the 1840s and the, in quotes, technology of the seance starts out with, again, sort of the knocks.
And exactly.
That's, did you hear that knock?
Right.
Well, obviously, as time progresses, we have to come up with new gimmicks and,
exactly.
and up the technology a little bit.
People, other mediums would be competing for audiences, and people got a little bored with just hearing knockings, so they came up with methods of full-on spirit manifestations.
Smell-o-vision here.
That's right. other mediums were known as trance mediums, and they would become like channelers possessed by spirits, and they'd be able to discuss topics that it was thought that a woman would not know anything about, wouldn't know anything about, unless they had been possessed by a masculine spirit. And that kind of leads to this, as it was mostly women being mediums.
I was going to say, break in. So this was, again, it was obviously most of the people who are dying during the Civil War, if it's not illness, are men.
Yes.
And so
yeah.
They're much like after World War II in England, there's just sort of a dearth of men. And so women are more active in society to some extent.
Exactly. And throughout society, as you're absolutely right, nursing becomes a female possession, profession rather, because of the Civil War. Yeah, a little Freudian slip there. At the time, women were not supposed to speak in public on issues of science or philosophy. By claiming that you have been possessed by, George Washington, now you are able to discuss politics in a public setting.
Because you're George.
Because you're George Washington. You're not,
Mary Fox or Mary Smith, or whatever.
So it was part of that overall new roles of women as well.
Wow. Okay. So we're upping the ante. We're coming up with tables levitating.
That's bringing
the spirit actually into the room. We're
exactly.
speaking in tongues. Whatever it is,
that type of thing, exactly.
So what?
I will. This is not Lincoln. Speaking of Mary Todd, Lincoln was. We don't know he attended at least one séance. Now, how much he actually believed in it is debatable. This became entertainment as well. Even skeptics would attend séances. It's estimated between 1848 and 1910, more than 50% of the American public attended at least one séance during their lives. A lot of them were taken by it. Like, there were skeptics, but many, many believers. Margaret Fox, one of the girls that started the movement, eventually confessed that that they had been faking it. But
I was wondering what happened to the two young ladies that started this whole thing.
Well, Margaret Fox is interesting. She claimed to have married Elijah Kent Kane, who was an Arctic explorer.
Any relation?
No relation to me, but he's an interesting fellow in his own right. And she claimed after his death to have been married to him briefly. She recanted her confession that they had been faking it, but by then their reputations had been tarnished, and both her and her sister, died. The classic
penniless.
Penniless.
Oh well. Anybody try to talk to them across the eons?
I guess. I don't know if they've been contacted. maybe we'll try that.
Yeah, they might try and collect on some of those old bills.
All right. Well, if you're out there, Margaret.
There she is. But can you tell me? I guess something else that grew out of this movement is, I guess, a hardening of science. Science, as it's developing, is starting to sort of exert itself like, hey, wait a minute, hold on. What we're doing is actually real.
Right.
What they're doing is actually not real. And so we need to now maybe assert ourselves and prove that what we're doing has some, the telegraph actually is communicating.
It's real, yes. there was a commission by the University of Pennsylvania, created at the University of Pennsylvania, called the Siebert Commission. And it was endowed by a Mr. Siebert, who was a spiritualist and but he wanted to have scientific methods put to it to prove its existence.
Just the fact that he's going to a major American university and endowing some sort of a chair
shows the amount of influence that this movement had had throughout society. Wow. Definitely.
So yeah. He goes to them, he endows this whatever it is to go out and
commission to go do investigations using the scientific method to try and prove the claims of many of these mediums.
How'd that go?
They did not find any evidence to support their claims.
Shocking.
I know. In fact, every case they examined, there was either fraud or suspected fraud.
So what happens next? Is that the end of the spiritualist movement?
No, not quite.
Why not?
People want to believe. Even after people are told that they were faking it, like by Margaret Fox, some people still said, no, you have powers. You're just claiming now that you didn't. Famous Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the writer of Sherlock Holmes, mm-hmm. was a spiritualist himself, and even when his friend Harry Houdini was a major debunker, would go, "This is how they do it." They would just go, "No, you don't believe, and you can't understand that there is a magical world out there."
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who made his career on
the most scientific, character,
he is a spiritualist.
Indeed, he was. But in the 1920s, because of Harry Houdini's work to debunk the leading mediums, and I think famously claimed to had a reward if you can show me that you have these powers, I can't remember the amount, but it was a lot of money for the time, and no one ever was able to claim it.
But he would. I'm pulling from a biography I read when I was 12 on Harry Houdini, but he would somehow get invited to these seances would sort of insert himself into them, like, "I'm coming to mm-hmm. debunk you." And these people would be, "Okay, sure, fine, because I'm real." And he'd come, and he would, sure enough, every time, debunk them.
Yes.
And in sometimes very embarrassing ways, right?
Yes, that would happen. But that brings up a good point that even though many of these people were employing tricks and to manifest as spirits, some of them genuinely believed that they were able to communicate with the afterlife, and they would rationalize the use of these tricks by saying people need to see something or hear something to fully believe it, even though they would claim to themselves that the spirits are really there, but we're helping them with these tricks.
So in believing it, though, that means that they must have had for themselves some proof, or felt like they had some proof of it.
One would think, one would hope.
Leaving us still with a little bit of doubt as to what it was that they were feeling or hearing or knowing,
right?
That we didn't, as they were lifting the furniture.
As they were lifting the furniture. Some of it, I think they were, wanting to make some money. That's certainly not a lot of them became wealthy as mediums. Some of them were generally wanting to help people, kind of like an early form of grief counseling, wanting to give people solace by contacting their loved ones.
And this was kind of the purpose of it to start, or is it really blossomed
out of the Civil War and after, during World War One? I mean, anytime you have.
And there isn't really grief counseling at that.
There wasn't.
During that
there
period.
Wasn't. Also, it was, as we mentioned, a way for women to do things that they normally wouldn't have gotten a chance to do. So
it's just it's a fascinating sort of collision of two. It's like a perfect storm, I suppose, in a way of just so much misery and the advent of science and confusion over that, and you were talking too about women. Women taking on these new roles, and it allows, I guess, them to talk about these things they're not supposed to be talking about, and it becomes sort of an avenue for communication about women's rights as well?
Certainly. One of the I read that a lot of the advice that the spirits would give through the mediums to other women was permission to get a divorce.
Oh, wow. Well, that's handy.
Yeah.
And so they were very liberated in the spirit world.
That's right. That if you were in an unhappy marriage with a man, the conventions of the time said you stuck it out.
But
these spirits said, "Go ahead and divorce. Get out of that bad situation.
That's fascinating. So today, in our modern society, we still have some of this left over a little
Sure. The modern New Age movement is pretty much an outgrowth of the spiritualist movement. They still have channelers. Sometimes now, instead of spirits, they're saying they're channeling alien beings or...
Rocks.
maybe.
Whatever.
Whatever. But yes, there's certainly still that desire to know about the unknown has not left us.
And even some of of course, we have ghost hunters. And
certainly.
We have numerologists, and people still are interested in their horoscope. And, you know, we were talking about
Nancy
Mary
Reagan.
Todd Reagan. Yeah, Mary Todd Lincoln. And then you've got Nancy Reagan, on the other hand, many, many, many moons later, who's got her
astrologers in the White House, certainly. So,
amazing.
It's a fascinating subject, and I'm glad that we've been able to come up with this program at the American Civil War, because it's given me an excuse to look more into
this
fascinating topic.
Great excuse, frankly. Well, thank you for coming. Again, this is American Seance at the historic Tredegar, the American Civil War Center.
Yep, we're going to be doing a traditional seance sitting where a family is going to try and contact their dead son who died during the American Civil War. So I hope you all can go.
Okay, so it's a reenactment. In a way.
Exactly.
In period kind of.
It'll be a period experience. Yes, we'll be. It's kind of a piece of theater. We don't expect actual contact with the spirit world.
But you never know.
You never know. Come and find out.
Is the public going to get to participate a little bit in this? Or?
They'll be. In the audience.
Close enough.
That's
close
right.
Enough. They'll be knocking on some tables or something.
They will witness the proceedings, no doubt. And it's we're going to have two performances every night at the, as I said, Monday through Friday, October 29th through November 2nd at 7 and 8. So I hope you all can come. And if you want more information, you can go to our website at tredegar.org.
All right. And anything for the kids there as well, or is this family-friendly?
It's family-friendly, certainly. It'll be a little spooky, but I don't think it'll be too terrible for the kids. So I think it'll be a nice for the families to come out. And if you've never been to Tredegar Ironworks at night, it's kind of a very scenic and kind of spooky in its own right. So
beautiful yet spooky.
Beautiful yet spooky.
All right. And again, I'm with Sean Kane. He's the museum educator at Historic Tredegar, and thank you very, very much, and
thanks
happy Halloween. Whoa, hey, the lights just blinked.
Just
see
flicker. That was kind of spooky. Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Thank you.
Satan is real, working in spirit. You can see him and hear him in this world.
WRIR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, call 804-771-5715 or visit www.kaufmanandknowles.com.
But sinner friend, if you're here today, Satan is real too, and hell is a real place. A place of everlasting punishment.
Satan is real, working in spirit. You can see him and hear him in this world every day. Satan is real, working with power. He can tempt you and lead you astray.
1981 film The Beyond, a young woman moves into an old hotel and discovers that there were a couple of things that the landlord didn't mention when she signed the lease. Namely, that it was built over a pit from hell. This classic Italian horror film will be the centerpiece of the Halloween Horror Showcase this Saturday night at the Visual Arts Center. Also being screened is an acclaimed horror shot by director Keith Allen called A Barge in Its Wind. And there'll be other thrilling surprises on hand too, including a horror trivia contest with prizes from Fangoria magazine. We've got two of the curators of the Halloween Horror Showcase with us today to talk about this special event and to discuss the art of the horror film. Jeff Roll from the James River Film Society and horror film aficionado Doc Gillespie. Welcome, guys.
Howdy.
Great to be here.
First off, this isn't the first Halloween Horror Showcase, is it?
No. Last year, we started it as kind of an experiment to see if we had an audience out there. And we kind of set up expecting like maybe 40, 50 people to show up, and we got twice that many. So, we decided to take it into a second year.
Mm-hmm. What did you screen last year? What was the movie?
Last year.
Pumpkinhead.
Pumpkinhead, yeah.
Okay. Right.
And that was directed by Stan Winskin, who is a Virginia boy.
Yeah. Well, how much is the event and where can people get tickets?
$5 admission. Mm-hmm. You can get tickets online at our website, the James River Film Society. It's jamesriverfilm.org, and we sell out at 100 tickets.
Right. So get them fast.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, our listeners may or may not be aware of the James River Film Society and all the great motion pictures that it brings year-round to Richmond movie fans. Tell us a little bit about the society, Jeff.
Well, it all started out in 1993 with the James River Film Festival, and that was VCU professor Michael Jones curated that. And in the late 90s, he met James Parrish from Chapel Hill, North mm-hmm. Carolina. He was head of a program called Flicker, mm-hmm. which was about small gauge filmmaking, Super 8, regular 8, 16 millimeter, that type of a thing. And they decided to come together as a preliminary organization, nonprofit organization called the Richmond Moving Image Co-op. Mm-hmm. And just a few years ago, we changed our name to the James River Film Society to just kind of bring everything together.
Doc, give me a little bit about your background. You're known as the horror film guy around here.
I've been known as the music guy, the horror guy, the book guy, the Civil War guy. But in the mid-90s, I moved from Richmond to Hollywood, California, and opened up a store on Melrose Avenue that was called the Goblin Market. It was a store that specialized in horror, science fiction, fantasy, and cult films, which I'd pulled from out of my own personal collection of just 10,000 videos, I guess, that were just mm-hmm. in that kind of vein. And it was quite popular. Most of my clientele were industry people, a lot of directors.
You mentioned Tarantino.
Quentin Tarantino was a regular customer. Rob Zombie, Jonathan Demme would pop in. Guillermo del Toro, who's a big favorite of Jeff mm-hmm. and I's. And, you know, rock stars, special effects guys were some of the most fun guys that would come by there all the time. And we had everything from the silent film genre on up, a lot of obscure films. And I was always looking for the most complete, uncut versions of a lot of these films. And horror films and cult films, fantasy films from all over the world. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of films that were in its original language that maybe weren't dubbed or subtitled, but might have been the only way that you could get them at the time, like a film like Santanica Pandemonium, which was a character that appeared in From Dusk Till Dawn. I had a print of that film. I think it was the only place in Los Angeles that had a copy of that movie. A lot of obscure kind of things like that. I would get them any way that I could find them, and I would exchange them later on if I could find a dubbed or a one with subtitles or even a more complete print. Mm-hmm. So it was the kind of go-to place for people that enjoyed genre films.
Well, you two guys are curating this event along with Bobby Morgan from the Geeks of Doom and WRIR's own Phil Ford, right?
Correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Talk about The Beyond and why you chose to screen it for this year's Halloween Horror Showcase.
It's a zombie film, and zombie films are pretty popular.
It's not just a zombie film, is it?
It's an Italian zombie film. And Italian zombie films, as Italian horror is, has a tendency to be very, very atmospheric. And this one is pretty intense. It's about one of the more intense zombie films I think I'd ever seen.
It really pushed the envelope of film violence back in 81. it was pretty shocking back then.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what differentiates that film and other Italian horror films from American-made horror films? And you say it's the atmosphere.
Yeah, they're big on atmosphere. Not a lot on making sense a lot of times with the plot. It's just what looks good, right. What looks best. Like a film like Suspiria, where you have this ballet school, and for some reason has one room that's full of razor wire. I mean, why would you do that? Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it looks great on the screen.
Right, right. And I'm sure it figures into the plot, too, right? Well, what makes a good horror film? Is it the plot, the suspense, the special effects, all of the above?
It's all of the above, but it depends on how much you use it. I think a lot of modern filmmakers have a tendency to rely more on CGI and special effects than they do on atmosphere.
And you can always, to me, I can always tell that stuff, and it kind of takes me out of the picture a bit.
I like a slow build-up, you know, where the tension just starts to build up. And a lot of filmmakers in the past had a tendency to rely more on that in building up the frights instead of just throwing everything in the kitchen sink at you like they do now.
I was going to say that a lot of today's horror films seem kind of bent on presenting gore and sudden shocks in lieu of character development and plot. What is the current state of the horror film, according to you guys? Do you think we're in a renaissance, or do you think we're in a downside?
The 70s is when the slasher films, you know, started, and that became a genre in itself.
It burned itself out in the 80s,
really. You're talking about your Friday the 13th, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street.
And even the Italians, a lot of the films that they were, some of the Argento films at that time were basically slasher films. It's a gloved hand with a straight razor or a knife or whatever. But I'm seeing some good things here, like recently with like the revival of the old Hammer Studios. They are starting to put out films again.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's the studio that brought us some of the classic films, film versions of, that were more modern, of like Dracula, you know, with Christopher Lee, and revived the Frankenstein series
and
things
Cushing
like that.
And those actors, yeah.
Some of the Japanese stuff in the last decade, 15 years, has been American remade to successful audiences. But I always prefer the Japanese originals.
Right, right. Well, speaking strictly of movies that deal with the supernatural, what are some of your favorites? I know that you were anxious to talk about ghost movies, and that's a genre that's really of interest to me as well.
We mentioned Guillermo del Toro earlier, and his 2001 film, The Devil's Backbone, is one of my favorites. About a boy in an orphanage, his father was killed in the war. I guess it's the paranoia of a child dealing with such terror.
And he did did he do Pan's Labyrinth as well?
Yes, that's
right. And then that's also maybe got the same theme, really, about the child.
Yeah, true. It's all about children with him. Orphanages are also a recurring theme.
Well, what about you, Doc? Some of your favorite ghost movies?
One of those happens to be one of Guillermo del Toro's top six fright flicks, and that would be The Innocents, directed by Jack Clayton.
Very subtle movie.
In 1961. It's gorgeously shot. It stars a very, very young Pamela Franklin, as well as Martin Stevens, one of the creepy little kids from Village of the Damned. Pamela Franklin would also appear in another favorite of mine, Legend of Hell House.
That was one that scared the daylights out of me when I was a kid.
Yeah, it was about 12 years later in 73. And I like, there's a 40s film, The Uninvited, with Ray Milland.
Yeah.
That was a big favorite.
Any more recent ones? Because, you know, when I look at the ghost movie genre, I'm normally thinking of older movies, too.
Well, my favorite is the 63 film, The Haunting, that Robert Wise did. I think that for pure scares is like one of the all-time best, and we're like less is more. But of recent films, I'd say Hammer did a remake of a BBC film called The Women in Black, and that was done recently with Daniel Radcliffe from the Harry Potter films. And that's been about one of the most scariest ghost films that I've seen, like, in a while. And it's great, the fact that it's Hammer Studios' film. The other funny thing about it is that in the original version that was done, I think sometime in the late 80s or so, maybe about 89, the actor that played the lead role in that was the same actor that played Harry Potter's father in all the Harry Potter movies. And so then here's the actor who plays his son is playing the lead role in the remake of Women in Black.
But it's a very, very
casting
coup there.
Yeah, it was very, very good.
What about monster movies? I'm not really too crazy about films that just offer up gore and kind of random cruelty, but John Carpenter's The Thing is one that I can watch again and again because I think it has not only over-the-top special effects, but it really builds an atmosphere of dread.
I love the original.
I like the original.
Which, well, it doesn't say it, but it's basically a Howard Hawks film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think John Carpenter did an excellent job, you know, with his remake of actually taking it back to the core of what the original novel was based
on. Right, it was called The Thing from Another World.
Yeah.
Jeff, monster movies, any that jump out at you?
A recent film put out in the last 10 years, a Korean picture called The Host, had the monster, but with an oddball sense of humor about it, too. I think that's available streaming on Netflix now if you want to check that out. The Host is the name
of
it.
The Host.
Yes.
What about the original Alien? That's another favorite of mine, the one directed by Ridley Scott.
Alien, that took science fiction, what had normally been a science fiction genre, and brought it right back to a pure horror film again.
Mm-hmm.
There was, I think, some producers of the original It, Terror from Beyond Space attempted to take them to court. That was a film that seemed to have a lot of the same, shared a lot of the same elements that Aliens did.
A monster stows away aboard the ship.
But Alien, that's been a real classic in its genre. I think James Cameron did a roller coaster ride, you know, with the remake of it,
right,
which just, you know, it just is unending. But the original film, I think, for just pure atmospherics, is one of a kind.
Talk about some of the great Italian horror films people should check out. When I think about Italian horror, the name that frequently pops up is Dario Argento.
Suspiria. We've got to start with Suspiria.
Yeah.
It also has one of the loudest soundtracks, I think, ever recorded for any film.
And did he do his own soundtracks?
He generally used this Italian band called Goblin. He worked very closely with them, and they scored quite a number of his films.
Mm-hmm.
And the soundtrack itself is pretty entertaining on its own. But it really just comes out at you in the theater. Once again, it's one of these Italian films that it's like atmospherics, suspense. You don't know what's happening next.
Plus, he has a unique way of shooting scenes, a slow pan across a very ornate set, only comparable to someone like Peter Greenaway. It's kind of artsy in a way.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah. I've noted that before. That he seems to be very precise filmmaker. He's not leaving too much up to chance, it seems.
It also had a look about it that I don't think could be reproduced because they were using old film stock. When it was developed, it kind of came out in a kind of a rather unique way. I think he tried to reproduce it like later, but he really couldn't do it. So it's just by accident that it has like this like really, really, you know, the color just really, really shoots out at you in that film.
The film you're screening at the showcase, The Beyond, like you say, it's about zombies. Talk about the zombie film. Talk about some of the favorites and how has that thrived? I mean, it just seems like it's almost its own genre, the zombie film.
Oh, it is. It is. Zombie films, I guess, first started with Bela Lugosi and White Zombie. And so it's a genre that's been around like for a long time. And there's the Val Lewton film, I Walked with a Zombie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
But it wasn't until George Romero came along
and
took the ball and ran with it.
That still has a lot of impact, that movie.
Oh, yeah.
If it's low budget, actually adds to the specialness of it.
Yeah, the Romero films, I think, still are some of the standouts in that particular genre.
Is he still making those? He's still making those,
He's still around.
Oh, yeah.
He's good friends with Argento, too.
Oh, okay. Well, wouldn't you want to be at that table when they have that conversation?
He started the slow-moving zombies that came to standard like for quite a long time, although that rule's broken, I guess, in Dawn of the Dead. Two children, which were special effects guys, Tom Savini's nephews, nephew and niece, come running out of a closet, and that's the only time that any of the zombies actually run in any of those films that Romero ever did.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, you can get away from
them. It seems like such a simple idea. Hey, wouldn't it be scarier if these guys could actually move like real human beings, you know?
I think it's just sheer numbers. You just get overwhelmed by the numbers.
You kind of got that in the British film 28 Days Later.
Where they start running.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they're really technically not zombies, but they're infected people.
Right.
So you can argue that point.
Let's pull back a little bit and kind of widescreen. What makes people want to be scared out of their wits like this with tales of ghosts, the devil, and the occult? What is the appeal? Why do we love this so much?
It's like roller coaster rides. You know, it's the same appeal, that thrill, that kind of vicarious thrill of, wow, I might die.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's the pure effect of the imagination is the most scariest thing mm-hmm. that was so effective in the work of H.P. Lovecraft, you know. Mm. The imagination is probably a key on what scares you the most, because $100 million of CGI can't come up with what you can conjure in your own mind.
Well, the current trend in ghost movies is this Paranormal Activity mm-hmm. series, which seems to have been inspired by the Blair Witch Project. What do y'all think of those films and the kind of current lo-fi horror movement?
Found footage pictures.
Found footage pictures. Because I like some of them, and some of them I'm like, didn't really do much for me.
Well, Blair Witch was, that was a film I wish I'd thought of first.
it's such a low budget, so simple an idea too.
It was a great idea, and the way that it was done, it really, really worked. It definitely put people in the seats.
Mm-hmm. Once again, using the imagination against you, your own imagination. You know, they weren't using, you know, millions of dollars of special effects to scare you. It was all in your head.
It's the scariest place to be, maybe.
Yeah. I think...
I know it is in my head.
An Australian picture, I believe it was an Australian picture, possibly New Zealand. It's called Lake Mungo. Did you see that one? Yeah. That was a fairly effective found footage picture. But it is a genre that's being bled to death.
Yeah, they seem to come out every 8 months, those films.
What was it, Cloverfield? Again, where you've got handheld
monster
kind of
movie.
Yeah, it's more of a monster film, but it's where you're still, like, you're using so much of mm-hmm. Kind of handheld kind of camera.
And I was wondering when they were going to come up with the whole idea of using these ghost hunter shows, and then there's this Grave Encounters movie. I don't know if you've seen that.
But, haven't seen that yet.
It's it was mixed, you know, but the plot is great, you know. The smirking, over-the-top ghost host comes in, and he basically gets, you know, everything that you want him to get, basically. I'm Don Harrison, and I've been talking to Jeff Roll from the James River Film Society. You can find out more about all the great movie events sponsored by the Society by going to jamesriverfilm.org. And we've also been joined by Doc Gillespie, horror film expert, two of the creators behind the Halloween Horror Showcase, which happens tomorrow night at the Visual Arts Center. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay. I understand you guys are pleading insanity, claiming demonic spirits possess you to do these hideous murders. Can you please explain to this court how these so-called spirits may do it to these raving madmen?
Be a witness as I exercise my exorcism. The evil that lurks within, the sin, the terrorism. Possessed by evil spirits, voices from the dead. I come forth with grave diggers in a head full of dread. I've been examined ever since I was semen. They took the sonogram and seen the image of a demon. At birth, nurses surrounded me with needles.
Broadcast of WRAR is made possible in part by VCU Arts and the Virginia Center for Architecture, ica.vcu.edu.
Boy, don't you go in there! Come out of there, boy! Don't you know that house is Hanny's?
If you believe some people, sitting around just the right campfire, Richmond is swarming with ghosts. From colonial plantations to outdoor parks to refurbished industrial buildings, River City can claim numerous paranormal hotspots, just teeming with spirit voice phenomena, darting shadow figures, angry poltergeists, and high EMF readings. Joining us today on Open Source RVA are two guys who know all too well how haunted this town really is. Big Ray Rucker and Ken K.B. Ballos are the founders of RIP Paranormal Investigations. And they also host a weekly Friday night radio show on WHAN called Ghost Raps. There, they interview other paranormal researchers and ghost experts, and they present some of the evidence they have found as they travel across the Richmond region in search of the supernatural. Hey, thanks you two for coming on Open Source RVA.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Tell me a little about your background and what got you two interested in investigating the paranormal.
What got me into investigating the paranormal was previous experiences. My grandfather told me stories growing up and other family members. So writing a book that I'm working on, I started taking pictures of the old home place back in 2000. And I captured my first ghost on film and went to another site, took another picture. something else was different. Came back, had the photos processed, and found the anomalies. Got to talking to other people. Ended up forming a group. Then we started investigating and moved into not only homes, but residences of residences that we can't, of course, disclose. Mm-hmm. And then popular, right, businesses, plantations, and that kind of thing. And we've captured a lot of different cool evidence.
KB, what about you?
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm KB. I'm a co-host with Big Ray on Ghost Raps Radio. We just don't talk to talk. We walk to walk. We're between investigators of the paranormal. And I tell you what, I had experience back when I was probably about 18 years old. I was staying over at a friend's house, and it snowed one night, so I couldn't make it home. About 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and saw a guy standing in the hallway between the kitchen and the bathroom area. And he was standing there just weaving back and forth. Well, I thought it was this guy's dad. So I said, hey, what are you doing standing there looking at me this time of night? He never said anything. He just stood there weaving back and forth. So I reached behind me, cut the light on. When I cut the light on, it wasn't a soul there. A few minutes later, I cut the light back off, and he was still standing there. Guess what I did?
Ran?
No, I slept with the light on.
That would be the normal thing.
Yeah. If I would ran, I would have ran somebody over.
Yeah. He'll take you out.
Well,
yeah.
Do people contact you to look into these supposed hauntings, or do you seek them out after hearing there's activity there?
No, we receive a lot of inquiries via the internet. You know, theghostraps.com, a lot of people go there and contact us by email and by phone. That's one thing that's a little different about us and the other groups are that we post our phone numbers so people can call us. A lot of groups that you'll see online will not post phone numbers. And So in our experience in contacting other groups, we found that we don't really do business with those kind of people because you can never get in touch with them. Right, and we want to be readily available. If somebody needs help, then, you know, we're there for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we're also licensed in the Circuit Court of Hanover County, and we're LLC in the state of Virginia. So we do it as a business, not as a hobby. You got a lot of groups out there who do it as a hobby, and, you know, you got to be careful who you get to investigate.
What are some of the most active places in the area that you visited, and what evidence have you compiled? What are some of the top things that you've uncovered?
Well, unfortunately, like I said a few moments ago, we're not allowed to mention names of places. So one of the most active places I can't reveal, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. However, I would have to say Tuckahoe Plantation has been very active.
Right.
We captured I was taking a picture of KB out on the walk, and I captured a headless man in a photograph, and you can see he's so close to me, you can see the thread in the material in his shirt. Light anomalies there, orbs, of course, and there's the story of the ghost lady on the walk. I actually almost ran into her. I did get to see her there.
Yeah, she's a rather famous spirit.
Right, and also temperature change.
Yeah, it was a lot of different stuff there. So Tuckahoe Plantation, you were with us at the Weston mm-hmm. Plantation, mm-hmm. and we captured anomalies there on film and on audio. Mm-hmm. You heard those. And I became ill there and went outside, and I was fine.
Yeah,
I don't know what that was about, but that was a little strange.
Yeah, I know you can't be specific, but I remember you guys talking about a residence in Henrico County that was particularly active. Do you remember which one I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's the apartment, a mm-hmm. small apartment building that we can't, again, disclose. Right. But, yeah, that was one of our more, I hate to use the word demonic, but if there is, that one has a very bad spirit in it. It caused injury, illness, and I don't even like to say it. We've talked about it, but, you know, that fellow that was a friend of ours, I think it may have cost him his life.
Really?
Yeah, he passed away in the house. And this whole house,
it was bad.
So strange. It was bad. Nobody could live in it but him. And the reason he said that he stayed there because that's the only thing he could afford.
Yeah.
And people that moved into the residence would move out within days.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been slapped, pulled
out of
the
bear, out of the bed, by his ankles. A deacon saw him pushed out, and he didn't just fall down the stairs. He saw, from what he told us, a black mass form behind him and pushed him literally out into space. He flew down the stairs. He had had surgery, his abdomen, the staples, you know, separated, mm-hmm. intestines spewed forth, and they thought he was dead. He did live several months after that, but this place was pretty wild.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a bad place.
Tell me a little bit about the team. You guys have quite a team that helps you on these investigations. How many people go on these trips to investigate?
Well, it varies. Mm-hmm. It depends on what the size of the location of the property. We've had as many as 8 guys going on an investigation. Ray and I like to take usually about 4. Only have, we have a special tech, we have intuitives on our team, things like that. And Big Ray will tell you we do sweeps in the whole 9 yards. So it depends on the location.
Yeah. Right. And I guess if you
minimum
took
4
too many people, then you'd have a lot of contamination.
You'd
have a lot of extraneous noises and stuff.
Yeah. And everybody has not only their job on the team. We don't, a lot of people, we get requests every week of wanting to join the team. But mm-hmm. we have criteria that we have to meet. They have to not only be able to do what we do, and we teach them to do what we do properly, but they have to have a job on the civilian side that accents what we do and mm-hmm. what we do, so that the investigations, I don't want to say fruitful, but they're either properly done and we can do things and debunk things in a normal
right.
way that, we can say, you're right, we don't have a lot of contamination around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we want to eliminate contamination, and we want them to be able to, like, we have maintenance people. You mm-hmm. know, is it a toilet, is it a pipe in the wall, is it electricity, is it, wired properly, that
right,
kind of thing.
Right, people from different backgrounds. Like, for instance, KB, I think you came from a law enforcement
Yeah,
background.
I come from law enforcement, and like I said, we do the investigation as if we were doing a crime scene. We take everything step by step. We observe it. We have a background investigator that goes back and tells us a little bit about the history of the property.
Mm-hmm.
So, basically when we go into the property, it gives us an idea of what we're dealing with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we'll start from scratch and investigate it as you were a homicide or a burglary or anything like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm also a former observer trainer controller from the military and an investigator. So I'm used to training people and investigating, like KB on one side, me on the other. So,
right, you can bring that experience.
Right, and we have other law enforcement personnel on the team, attorney, medical people, that kind of thing.
Well, like you said, I'm familiar with you guys because you allowed me to accompany you on a nighttime investigation for of Weston Plantation near Hopewell.
Right.
And it was for a feature story that I wrote for Style Weekly, and it was really a fascinating experience. How many investigations like that do you do each year, ballpark figure?
Total investigations?
Mm-hmm.
So, sometimes it's really kind of hard to tell. Sometimes we'll do 4 in a month. Sometimes we do 1 a month. Sometimes we do 2. It depends on the season, and there's environmental factors that come into play
mm-hmm.
Because there's, let's say, the humidity. Paranormal world, high water content in the atmosphere can, in some cases, decrease the amount of mm-hmm. paranormal activity. So the summer months usually aren't good. In addition to that, which is kind of cool, that a lot of people go on vacation, so we get kind of a break.
Yeah.
So that works out. But usually we try to keep it to 2 a month because of the amount of material that we have to go over, video, the still pictures, mm-hmm. the audio, and all that.
Yeah, I often wonder about that.
Yeah,
it
takes
considerable
weeks.
Post-production time of actually going through all
this. Yeah, it's a lot.
Well, most of what people know about paranormal investigations are what they see on TV shows, like Ghost Adventures and Ghost Hunters. How similar are your investigations to what we see on those shows?
Well, we're quite similar. We do something that most of them don't do. We use dowsing rods, which a lot of the guys on the television show don't even use.
Right, I remember you guys doing that.
And so we do use that. And like I said, we have a history research team which researches the property. We have an intuitive. It's amazing. One mm-hmm. of our girls on our team has told us things that has shocked us.
Mm-hmm.
We did an investigation last year where the guy told us the history of the property, but he didn't tell us about the little girl that was murdered on the property.
Mm.
And she kept telling Big Ray and I that night, the little girl wants to play at the ball. And Ray and I looked at her like, are you drinking? And the man said nothing to us about a little girl. And come to find out at the end of the investigation, the little girl was shot in the head at the top of the steps during the Civil War. The guy that owned the plantation back then, they had the Union on one side and the Southern guys on the other, bombarding the place with bombs. He went berserk and killed his butler, mm-hmm. and it shot his little girl. And it's the place is known to have Confederate soldiers still to this day walking the property inside mm-hmm. the house. And the little girl, they say, they see her from time to time.
Yeah. Well, so she felt that. And
she felt it, and she described the girl, what it looked like.
Yeah.
Big Ray can test to the Poe Museum. Tell them a little bit about the Poe Museum, what she described, Big Ray.
Well, she described a female, Edgar Allan Poe, of course, everybody mm-hmm. knows. Some of them don't know that he actually resided here in Richmond. Well, the Poe Museum is in the oldest building in Richmond. So we went down there. Tina said, Ray, I need this. I need some paper. I need some paper. I'm like, okay, here it is. Because we keep her sequestered away, like down there.
Yeah, I noticed that she was standing outside for quite a period of time while you guys investigated first.
Right. And went so I gave her the paper, and she drew a picture of a woman, and I have this. And then there was one room that we had not been in. And then the curator took us into the room, and I happened to have the notepad that I gave her, and the picture she drew is of a picture of one of Poe's bows. And it was the chevrons on the sleeve matched, the hair matched. I didn't know she could draw that well. And it was really wild. And the story is that there was a little girl and a little boy on the property. And she described that woman in the garden out back and the two kids. And we didn't even know that the story about the two kids yet.
Mm-hmm. And she told all about it.
Yeah. And that was pretty wild. So you were asking what makes this a little different. KB alluded to the sweeps. Well, we do sweeps with the dowsing rods. Then we do sweeps with the K2 EMF detectors. Then we send in the intuitives, but we have somebody recording everything while they're doing it, make a map of the property. And then we overlay all that information. And then we compare that to what the owner or the manager, whoever is, mm-hmm. In charge of the property, along with the history that we find. So we're doing things like that to substantiate and to back up what one or the other person says.
Well, hey, tell me about Ghost Raps, your radio show on WHAN. I'm told you're the only paranormal radio show on the dial, except for Coast to Coast, I guess.
Yeah, the only thing, well, once again, what makes us different is we not only, as KB said, we don't only talk the talk, we walk the walk. So
right.
We're not only on WHAN, but we're streamed live. We're on BTBN, GTN, PCN, and Google TV. We have a lot of Hollywood types on, a lot of authors,
I noticed you
actors,
have some psychics on.
Psychics, yeah. And we try to get the what we do is we test the psychics, trust but verify. We have a show coming up at the end of the year. It's going to be a big end-of-the-world party.
Yeah, it's going to be nationwide. It's going to be a worldwide show. Yeah, it's going to be worldwide. And Big Ray and I, next week, we'll start our sixth season on Comcast cable and
it'll be on Fios as well.
Oh, great.
But the other show, it's Countdown to Mayageddon.
So stay tuned to go to ghostraps.com and find out more about that.
Yeah.
Right?
Check it out.
Well, we've been talking to Ray, Big Ray Rucker, and Ken, KB Ballos of RIP Paranormal Investigations, and they're the hosts of the Ghost Raps weekly radio show. For more on their efforts, go to ghostraps.com. And it should be noted that the Style Weekly article that I wrote about their Weston plantation investigation is posted right now on the open source RVA website, along with links to some of the video and audio evidence that they've collected. Thanks, you guys. Be careful out there.
Hey, appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Don. Appreciate
you
having us back.
You've survived another episode of Open Source RVA. It's Halloween week, and today is Friday, October 26, 2012. Looking for more fright? Check out our Facebook page at Open Source RVA for breaking news, as well as to channel From Beyond, podcasts of this and past week's episodes. I'm Chris Dovey, and my co-hosts are Don Harrison and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi. Our board operator is Rachel Solomon. Try doing a bit of channeling across the ether yourself. Email us your comments, questions, and news tips at opensourcerva@gmail.com. We'll rise again next week to haunt you. And we might just get away with it, too, if not for those meddling kids.